Hey, welcome to an episode of the Endurance Mindset Podcast. You're with Brad Karanarthur. A couple of years back, I did a charity run up the east coast of Australia. It was one of those marathon a day for 100 days kind of things. And I figured that by the time I'd reached the top, I'd have mastered mental toughness, strength of will, and all those kind of things. I certainly got some insights into what determination is, but I feel like I was only scratching the surface on things like how to develop it. So I'm on a quest to understand the psychology of endurance, and I'm interviewing athletes, or anyone really, who knows the meaning of commitment. I hope you enjoy this episode. So, welcome everybody to another episode of the Endurance Mindset Podcast. This is the first time I'm actually doing an introduction. Usually I just like, jump in and see what happens and introduce it later. But this is evolving, and I'm getting a touch more professional as I go along. Anyway, this week I am graced by the presence of Scott and Kim Brennan, who are both Olympic rowers and both have gold medals to their names, doctor and a consultant, so a bit of a power couple. and a baby on the way for Kim, so no pressure on the baby in terms
and
of
me being... too.
Hey, yeah, okay, true, yeah. Okay, you are the father, I think.
Hopefully.
Yeah, brilliant. So, thank you guys. So, well, as a bit of a summary, Scott, you won in 2008 in Beijing in a double scull, and Kim more recently 2016 in Rio in the single scull, and then I tried to learn about various other races, but you've both been world champions at other well,
they're the only results that really matter, though, aren't they?
Yeah, they're the big ones.
Well, they stand out to to the lay people. To you guys, is the Olympics or the World Championships of rowing a bigger?
Definitely the Olympics.
By far and away, not even a comparison.
Really work our training in four-year cycles around each Olympics. So the World Championships are learning for the Olympics.
Yeah, and a bit of a yardstick to see where you are relative to the rest of the world, but yeah, like you wouldn't put anywhere near as much emphasis on the world champs as you did on Olympic goats.
Right. Okay. So when you enter an Olympic cycle, you're committing to what, like a particular build up across 4 years that you're committing then and there to that, and like 4 years away, is that the go?
Yeah, pretty much, isn't it? So like, I mean, you would. Each year you'd be working towards the World Championships, but you would have, you know, like the overall view of your Olympic cycle. You'd be saying, right, well, for this year and maybe the next year, we're working on, you know, endurance base or whatever it was, and then having distinct goals for each year in the four that was building up towards the Olympic Games themselves, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, so for example, after the London Olympics, we started the single scull project going to Rio, and the first year was about learning to row the boat and a strength base. So trying to put on a bit of weight, spending time in the gym to get a bit stronger. Second year was about that endurance workload. So that would have been the highest volume training that we did across the four-year cycle, which gives you the ability to train more and train better in the last 2 years of the cycle. The second last year leading into Rio was about race strategies, about equipment, boats, oars, fin placement, you know, trying different strategies around racing. And then that fourth year is really that just executing on what you've learnt and what you've done the previous years.
Or if you did like me, 2 years out to do medicine and then 2 years of frantic overtraining leading into the cycle and just cramming as much as you could. But so there was different ways of doing it, but Kim definitely did it the smarter way, that's for sure.
Right. The way you're describing, Kim, it sounds very much like building a house. Like lay the foundation and then put the things like stack on top of each other that are dependent on the previous thing. Like,
yeah, very much. And it in a lot of ways, it is, and that's often what's missed, is people will go to the type of training that delivers short-term results, which is actually the icing on the cake rather than making the right. cake itself. So example would be the vast majority of our training is actually that strength endurance base. But we do some, you know, faster speed work leading into a big event, and that has great results when you have a base to put it on top of.
Right, so you can do, well, you have to be patient in a way. Like, there's a certain type of training where you're not expecting to win the world champs this year, hence why that's not the more important race, because you're working on...
Well, you would always work towards performing the best that you could.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't... you wouldn't kind of set your entire sights on I'm going to be the world champion, as opposed to I want to, because the Olympic champion is like, that's the kind of thing that everyone wants to be.
Yeah.
And so certainly, like, it's still a great achievement to win a world championship. No one's arguing that. But
yeah,
if you ask any role, would you rather be world champion or Olympic champion? And they'll pick Olympic always.
Right.
And then there's different ways about doing it. So I mean, like, you can, that kind of methodical approach where you, each year you build a certain way to your Olympic Games, like, that might work for some, and maybe it is the best way, but it might not be. You know, see, like, there are other crews who just seem to do the same thing year in, year out, and go really well.
Yeah.
And don't really cycle their training a huge amount. But often what we would see and is that people would come out like flying at the start of the Olympiad, like in the first year after an Olympic Games, and be way ahead of the field, and then each year the field will just reel them in until they get knocked off during the actual Olympics. And so that's kind of your worst case scenario, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit of that, you know, trying to, what would you say, icing on the cake kind of thing. Yeah. It's like all icing and no cake kind of thing. And so, like,
yeah,
you know, if you want to have that, the absolute kind of best result you can get, you have to probably give up a little bit of the glory and stuff that you might have been able to get if you went out and chased a gold medal from day one for the world champs.
Right.
But it's that trade-off of, like, well, we're going to build a stronger base, and some people are good enough to do it all the way through.
Yeah.
But for the rest of us mere mortals, you've got to kind of approach it a bit more strategically.
Right.
And I think, I mean, in terms of the mental side of it, you still go and race at the world championships as if it is critically important that you put your best performance that you're capable of at that point in time on the water.
Yeah.
Because that's actually what you're practicing, that come the Olympics, when you have done the entire preparation that you wanted to do, your job is actually still the same as it was at each World Championships, was do the best possible job you can do at that point in time. It's just that, you know, come an Olympic Games, that you have done everything that you planned and wanted to do at that point in time to execute.
So it's even practicing sort of executing perfectly everything, or
it's probably not perfectly, because there's something that's quite constraining about trying to do something perfectly. You're trying to make each stroke better than the one before it. There's no point that you stop learning along the way, but I think sometimes coming back to the fact that all you can do in that Olympic final is what you've trained yourself to do,
right,
and you just have to not get in your own way. And yeah, I think that's something we often see at events like the Olympics, of that pressure and the notion of I have to perform right now,
yeah,
actually inhibits people's ability to produce what they're capable of at right that point in time.
Well, because they're expecting something beyond what they've got in the tank.
Can you they kind of start forecasting a bit, you know, because what the next 5 seconds are relevant, really. It's just like right here, right now. And so they're thinking, like, I need to win this race, but you don't actually win a race. You just do single, like a stroke after each stroke until you cross the line.
Right.
And if you get dragged too far outside of that awareness of all I've got is right here and right now, and I just have to do this stroke perfectly or the best that I can do, and then the next one and the next one.
Yeah.
If you start thinking, like, I need to be in front here, I need to be winning here, like, that's not helpful at all. Right. And you can't actually,
there's no action you can take to address that.
You've
abstract,
got no control over that. Whatever. The only thing you control is, okay, I've finished this stroke, and now I'm starting the next one. That's all you can control.
Right.
And you can see how it happens to people, like how they get dragged out of it in the big moments of the Olympic Games, because it's that once every 4 years thing as well, and it's the big event that everyone trains for.
Right.
But that being able to stay right there in the moment and actually just focus on what you need to focus on until it's finished,
yeah,
that's probably the key kind of mental skill that will really kind of define whether or not on the big day are you going to be able to cope it all, if you can stay within yourself.
And that's right, probably the other side of it, because Like, yes, you're doing the physical training, but what you can actually train yourself for over the 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, however long you do the sport, is that ability to be present and to concentrate for every stroke. And this is not just in racing. This is each time you do a squat in the gym. It's when you're out paddling around the lake. It may not be, this is going to be the fastest rowing piece I'm ever going to do, but you've got that intent of purpose and presence in the training that you're doing. And I actually think that ability to train concentration takes a really long time. Yeah. I don't know if you were more natural at it, but I definitely found that over the years I got a lot better at being able to be present,
yeah.
And genuinely aware but not alarmed of my surroundings for full training sessions.
What do you mean aware but not alarmed of your surroundings?
So be able to feel what the boat was doing, be able to feel what my body felt like. So I'd be aware of, yes, I'm producing a lot of lactate. Yes, my heart rate is up. Yes, this feels unpleasant. But not be scared or fearful about that, just to accept that, yes, this is what I feel like right now. This is what the boat feels like right now. But this next stroke, I am going to do X.
Right. So it sounds like to me is this parallel to what you were saying, Scott, in that when you think about too many things all at once, that produces the alarming feeling. But when you're able to break everything down into each of its components, which requires a lot of focus, as you're talking about, to think about all the different things and go, what is the thing that currently needs improvement? Like, what here in this system is the bottleneck or the rate limiting step? Or
yeah, because, I mean, like, we used to, because coaches as well can really throw a lot of things at you, and if they're not careful, they can say you need to work on this and that, and then when you think about this and don't forget this thing as well, it's all of a sudden there's like four or five different things.
Yeah.
Then you just can't focus on that much stuff when you're under, particularly when you're under physical duress as well.
Yeah.
So we used to say that for every session or every race that we were going out to, we had one major focus and one minor focus, and that was it. And you weren't allowed to have any other ones, you know. So the major one was, that was basically the main, like, that was all you would really focus on. And then if you had the capacity to think outside of that, you would also think, oh, don't forget that other minor focus that we had.
Yeah.
And so what that meant was that over time, you kind of focus for, say, however long it took, a week or 2 weeks or whatever, on this major focus, until you really kind of nailed that down. And then you go on to the next one. And then what we found is as you went along, the major focus actually, you would kind of hang on to those things that you'd been working on. And so then you would say, well, I'm going to work on this. But it included all of those things that you'd already been doing. So what it meant was that by the time you got to that really high-pressure situation,
yeah,
where, because everybody, you know, everyone reverts to type under high pressure,
yeah,
you've kind of ingrained this movement and your behaviours and your responses to stress so consistently and over so much time that when the pressure gets piled on, it's almost like that's a sanctuary. You can go into those movements and say, right, well, I'm just going to do what we've been doing. All those major focuses are now just rolling into one big thing.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to worry
about it.
Yeah, minor just components. It's all just, oh, I'm just going to row,
yeah,
which is what we just trained for 4 years, and then I'm going to race,
right,
which is a whole separate thing.
Yeah. So once you've got, let's say you've got the skill component down, and that appears to be coming in sort of the third sort of quarter phase of all of that, is the last phase like, okay, you've got that all that bedded down, and now it's a focus on like really exerting yourself and taking yourself to a space? Because let me just add one other thing about this, is that it seems to me that the body is stronger than the mind most of the time, that you can take your body to a place that your mind can't sustain for a very long period of time. So perhaps like the peak load of training that you get to just before the race that you're aiming for is the one where all the technique's down and you're really just giving it 110%.
I think I would almost reverse it to be, rowing's a sort of sport where often if you try harder and you go for that, I'm just going to work, physically exert myself as hard as I possibly can, that's quite a tense state and feeling that may not be as in tune with your boat. I think switching it the other way to those feelings of duress is just information that is coming at you. You might feel it, but you don't actually need to respond to it. And so I think it's the same outcome of getting to that point where you can actually exert as much as you possibly can, but it's not by focusing on that, it's by focusing on what you're doing and not getting distracted by, oh gosh, I've gone out too hard, there's too much lactate, this is really unpleasant.
Yeah.
So the feeling of exertion is not exertion per se, it's like thinking about every component of the stroke and the technique, and you're like, well, that's going to produce a more powerful stroke rather than just thinking pull hard.
Well, yeah, I think if we're talking about the back end, so when you're actually competing, the way that I used to kind of feel that the sensation probably would best articulate it was that you're just up above, like above things, almost looking down at it, or you've got your head up out of water. You know, so like early on in the cycle, everything seems bloody hard, you know, because you're not as fit. You're not as efficient. And so you're just like, it's a slog a lot of the time. And you work your ass off in those first kind of 2 years in particular, and then third as well, you start to sharpen up a bit. But that last kind of lead into the Olympics, that last year, was really about, you know, getting your racing down, but then having that feeling of like, you've done all the major skill work, and you've put all the kind of foundations for your house or your cake or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever we're creating.
In your house.
Yeah. We've got a roof on your cake. And so then the rest of it is actually being up above those kind of physical sensations that really don't matter a lot after a lot of time, right? So I don't know how to explain it, but one of the things I definitely noticed as I went further through my career was that when I was younger, I used to attach an emotional meaning to the sensations I was having, you know, so I'd row hard, I'm like, it hurts, or this is hard, or it's bad, or whatever. And then as I got further along, it's just like, rather, you know, a lot of people talk about fighting things, and for me it was much more of a surrender. It's just like, this is part of the job, you know, like you're never going to get away from that.
Yeah.
And the sooner you can just give up that bit of the struggle, that's energy you're no longer wasting. And so once I kind of thought, oh, well, it's just part of it, it just became a lot easier, and you just kind of straight away is like, well, it's probably going to feel shit, but that doesn't matter, and then just get on with it, and that just helps you get above all the noise and stuff that your body is kind of throwing at you, so you can focus on what actually matters, which is racing well and moving a boat well, or whatever it is that your sport requires. But working hard is like, that's entry level stuff that you shouldn't be worrying about when it crunches on.
Because there's that image of, like, you know, almost like devil and an angel in a lot of people's heads around how willpower works, and that, like, this fight between the thing you should be doing, the thing you shouldn't, and the exerting or not, and it's hard and it hurts. And that's just a level where, well, you haven't broken the thing down into all of its components yet. You're just seeing this as putting in effort or not.
It's like using the devil and the angel. It's sort of, you know, there's one school of thought that's about getting rid of the devil. I'm not going to have any negative thoughts. I'm going to be so positive. This is going to be the most amazing experience.
Yeah.
But the reality is you do have those feelings and you do have those thoughts.
Yeah.
It's almost like you race with the devil and the angel, and it's just ignoring the devil. It's like, yep, it's there. And how do you talk about it? It's actually a friend, you know.
I don't know, like, it was more just, for me, it was really I think my, like, perspective was a big thing for me, and so just to give a little bit of context, that I got, like, particularly unwell when I was 16, and my understanding of, like, kind of discomfort and what I would have defined as pain at that point in time abruptly changed very quickly, and so once I kind of got out of hospital and recovered after that, I just kind of had a bit of a change in my thought process around, you know, like, why am I calling this stuff hard and painful, and really what all this is just some, like, this, it's like an out of date protective mechanism, you know, so you get these feelings of exertion that your body's using as a warning sign because we didn't want to be overexerting ourselves, we're at risk of exhaustion and fatigue back in a time when we're at risk of dying from that stuff, whereas like in a rowing event or, you know, these types of things, like, you're not at actually immediate risk of. Oh, we're certainly not. I think some of those crazy 24-hour guys might be. But, you know, so, like, your body's giving you feedback to say, well, this is unsustainable, but we know in our heads, well, it doesn't need to be sustainable. It's a 7-minute race. Like, that's as much as you need to do. And so once I kind of started thinking more along those lines of, it's not actual pain, no damage is being done. This is just my body saying, be careful, this is a dangerous zone we're going into. It's like, I'm okay with that because there's not we're not in any danger. So you just, that doesn't mean anything. Let's focus on what matters.
Yeah, totally. Have you had a similar experience that transformed your understanding of pain, or is it, sorry, Kim, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there listening along, I'm just like switching my eyes, because it's something I'm very curious about is pain, do some people just happen to be born with a higher pain tolerance, or are there life-defining moments for some people that transform their understanding? For you, Scott, it sounds like there was something that changed your perspective.
Yeah, I don't think I had a similar, you know, life-changing experience, but I definitely remember back in, you know, primary school sport and, like, early secondary school sport, enjoying that challenge of actually just testing that limit. Like, there was one cross-country race where just collapsed and passed out just before the finish of the race, which I think was just my way of, you know, testing what I was capable of. And then yeah. you learn as, and I think as you train and you learn what your body's actually capable of, exactly what Scott said, you've trusted your training, you're so fit and you're so strong that this is not actually, you're not going to collapse, nothing's going to go wrong because you know you can do this.
Yeah.
And so it is just irrelevant information. It might feel like you can't push your legs down hard.
Yeah.
But if you focus on pushing your legs down hard,
right.
You do.
Right.
And so it was almost that that mental challenge of being okay with those sensations coming in and practicing it all the time. So, you know, would do a really hard session every week. And one of the main things to practice was just that composure under duress. You were doing work far harder than what a race would be, but you weren't doing it for a physical purpose. You were actually practicing that ability to just be calm and composed and clear.
Yeah.
In your mind to take into racing.
Yeah, there's that idea of you make the training harder than the racing, so right. When you actually get to race time, it seems relatively easier
right.
Because the difficulty then is replaced by the external pressures, and the pressure you're placing on yourself is what makes it particularly hard.
Right. And so it puts it in quite a different perspective when you're setting out to hurt. Like the point of today's session is to go beyond what we experience in a race, and that's the very reason that we're doing it. So you don't have to be scared about the idea of this being something you're expected to do again and again. It's just,
it is interesting because, like, you watch, like, there's American TV shows about, like, pre-race really firing up and being motivated and, you know, really rah-rah.
Yeah.
Let's get ourselves in a zone that we're absolutely going to
yeah.
hurt ourselves. That was never me in yeah. racing. Like, before racing, it was just about calming down. You know, I'd get really nervous. But it's about just being in a state that I could do what I'd trained myself to do.
I like this phrase, mainly because I came up with it. This phrase, high GI and low GI motivation. And that high GI is kind of like what you're talking about with the Americans, where you really feel amped up. And I use the terms associated with, like, it's the feeling you get when you're on a sugar high, essentially. Like, you can feel the motivation that you're experiencing. But on low GI motivation, I'm calling it that because it's like the experience of a sustained load of food that you can't even detect the feeling of motivation. It's just there.
Yeah.
It's like that cool, calm kind of thing. And it resonates a lot that really amped up stuff is, I don't know, not sustainable and or doesn't really get you anywhere. Would you agree, Scott, or do you think a different?
I'm never a big believer in blanket approaches, so I think for some athletes, let's use your example. So
yeah.
High GI works for some people.
Right.
I find it particularly tiresome, like just, yeah, people kind of doing all the revving up and stuff. And
yeah.
But if it works for you, then use it, you know.
Yeah.
And if low GI is the only thing you need, then like that kind of calm kind of thing, which you and I are both, Kimmy and I are both kind of like that, it works well for us. But I think I would agree instinctively, I feel that you're right, that if you need to be externally kind of motivating yourself, then, you know, like, I kind of wonder, how is it you managed to motivate yourself all the way through day in, day out for years on end,
right,
if you needed this kind of external, like high energy kind of stuff? Whereas, you know, for...
I guess if you're throwing a discus or doing a 100 metre sprint,
yeah, that's true.
You know,
yeah,
different...
Yeah, but I mean, you see some rowers doing that, you know, and yeah, so like, and I mean, we're talking about endurance sports here, so not so much your power sports, where I definitely understand the rowing up stuff would actually, it's been proven, I think, to kind of give you better outcomes in power sports. But, you know, for endurance, that kind of grinding stuff, well, I wonder.
I still find it relevant because to me, this is about like the endurance is in the training as well as the race, in that, like, that question of how does one sustain themselves over that long period of time? Well, I guess a shot putter or something relies on both types of of motivation to get themselves through.
So there's definitely an element of it when you're in a training phase where you feel awful, like you're exhausted and your eyes are dropping out of your head and... you see me try and get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's just that feeling of, oh gosh, I actually don't feel like I want to do this.
Right.
But accepting that this is part of it and do it anyway, and it doesn't really matter if you want to, if you don't want to, if you know what those feelings are, you're just going to go and start your session. And nearly always you get over that hump of, and you accept that you're there, and it ends up being quite a good session.
You reminded me of a question I was thinking about asking. I feel like I know the answer. What's harder, the third 500 or getting out of bed in the morning?
I mean, I love racing. I think it's, we don't get to race all that much. And these days. The third 500 is, like, it's still, like, it's an opportunity.
Right.
It's definitely, like, it is that point where... you know, a lot of your opposition are going to be struggling, and it is a great opportunity to make the most of everything that you've trained for. For me, definitely getting out of bed.
It's just ridiculous, isn't it? You would think that the third 500 of like an extreme like physical event is harder than getting out of bed. I've got no worries getting out of bed, so I'm going with the third 500 on that.
Oh yay. I love that. Yeah, I'm with you, Kim, on the definitely the find it hard to get out of bed in the morning. And I don't know, like, it's amazing how you can flip it so that you can turn a negative into a positive, because you're just like, well, for everybody else, it's hard. Therefore, I'm going to capitalize on that. That's cool. But for you, Scott, what, have you just nailed sleep hygiene or something like that?
I think because of, like, a couple of years of working shift work has destroyed any sleep hygiene I had. So I just, like... don't really give a shit anymore.
Right.
So I just tend to wake up at all sorts of hours and I just get out of bed. So
okay.
That's the way it is.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm curious, right? This is, first of all, sounds like a cliched question, but we're going to go deeper. What does it feel like to win a gold medal?
Who do you want to
answer that one? So I actually... crossing the line was in a little bit of doubt as to whether that was me imagining it or actually being there. I know it sounds really ridiculous, but I had visualised that so many times that it was a little bit surreal.
Yeah.
At that time, and I. Yeah, I think when it sunk in, probably satisfying would be...
Probably. Yeah. I'm not quite sure, but I think it was only satisfying, yeah. I don't know, like, I definitely knew when it happened for me, but I think a lot of it depends on the lead into and what you carried into that race with you, because it's not like you just kind of exist in this little... silo where you just rock up and you race, you know, so you kind of take in a whole lot of stuff with you. So for me, like, we had a really bad experience in our first Olympics in 2004.
Yeah.
And so, you know, every day I'd pretty much woken up saying I want to undo that memory, because we were favourites going in and then we didn't even make the final. It was really devastating. So there was that kind of sense of, I had like a bit of a sense of like wanting to find some revenge and stuff for that. So there was like this feeling of I need to be redeemed from the first Olympics that we did. And then the year after that Olympics as well, my coach who kind of taken me through all the junior rowing internationally and all that kind of stuff, he died from cancer shortly after the Athens Olympics. And the last kind of conversation that we had 2 nights before he died was about the Beijing Olympics and me winning a gold medal there. And so for me, like, there was a huge sense of relief because I had basically sworn on his coffin at his funeral that I would win that gold medal. And right. So it was a pretty dangerous thing to do, really.
Yeah.
it's pretty intense.
Yeah, a little bit. I realise that as I'm saying this. But it kind of gives some context to the fact that I felt a huge amount of relief that that it actually happened as I crossed the line.
Yeah.
And then there was this sense of almost like, it was almost distressing just how overwhelmingly happy I was in terms of I couldn't contain it, kind of feeling that I was just like, this is absolutely amazing, everything I've ever wanted.
Yeah.
Since I was 9 years old when I first saw a rowing race, had just, like, this was it that was happening right now. And, you know, I certainly haven't felt anything like that since, and I don't know if anything ever could feel exactly like that. I'm not saying things couldn't be good, but that's a very distinctive thing that has been built up over so long to come down to it right at that point in time. That's the unusual thing about the Olympics, is it's all your hopes and dreams and effort and time, like, right here and now. There's not many things that are like that at all. Most things kind of spread out over a bit of time, but right then and there, in front of the world, that's what happened.
Yeah. And Kim, did you have a point at which it transitioned as well? Like, for Scott, you've gone from relief and then it transitions in the form of that feeling to, like, bloody excited. Did that happen to you?
I think it was more, I got a lot more emotional, you know, speaking to Scott on the phone and when I got to see my coach. So it was a while afterwards until I got to see my coach, who had, you know, in a, when you're rowing a single scull, you essentially spend, you don't have a crew around you.
Yeah.
It was very much a, you know, a joint project. And I think that realisation of we actually did it was when it went from being just something that was a bit surreal to we invested so much in this, and that satisfaction of pulling it together when it mattered. I wouldn't say it was elation. I think it was probably closer to relief.
Yeah.
But then there have definitely been times since when I go and do a talk or something and they play parts of the race, and it's kind of looking at that as if that's someone else, as in, like, gosh, I wouldn't be capable of that.
Yeah. And then does that then fill you with a different kind of sort of excitement or something like that when you watch back on it? Or?
No, it just makes me feel really unfit and inferior.
It's very strange to be intimidated by your former self. Yeah, it's happened to me a couple of times.
Because you're trying to remember, how did I actually do that? If I had to go up against myself again,
I wouldn't stand a chance.
How would I? Yeah. It strikes me that the feeling of relief is it seems very fitting for professional athletes, in the sense that you're putting together a plan to execute something, and you've made that plan and you've covered off all angles. It's a bit like a builder doesn't feel excited when they finish a house. They're bloody glad that it didn't fall over. They're relieved that, like, yeah, it's a nice looking house and I built it as planned. And but of course, if you know, it's a different kind of event where you were.
Well, that's it. It's a complete gamble, because the best laid plans, there's no guarantee that you know, you use the best information that you have on hand to write the best training program and execute it the best way that you can in the equipment that you choose. You know, but there's no certainty.
You can't in control sport. The other athletes.
You can't control the other athletes.
Right.
And you actually can only do the best that you can do.
Yeah, I think also the gamble is with opportunity, and so that's what makes it very intense. So A lot of people talk about sacrifice in sport, and they talk about, like you're not going out partying or whatever. But I've always felt that the biggest sacrifice is all the other things you could have been doing, except you're just training every day. And so to give up your time, that's a huge sacrifice. And so then to know that all those years that you dedicated to it actually paid off and it worked out, like, that's where, for me, that's where the relief came. It's like, well, imagine all the things that we could have been doing with this time. If it hadn't worked out, that would have been tough, to think, well, that was time that perhaps was wasted that I'll never get back in, because it's all your prime years, and so I think that's where a lot of, for me anyway, that's where a lot of that relief came, as well as that when I talked about it with my coach, but just that feeling of the years that I'd put into it, I hadn't thrown away. Which isn't really the way you would look at it, even if you didn't win, if you know what I mean, but in terms of wanting to do the best performance you can, and every athlete out there wants their best performance to be that gold medal. There's not many people who say, I want to just win a bronze. And if you know that you're capable of it, to then go out and do it and know that you've, all that stuff that you've done leading into it was worthwhile, that was where a lot of the relief came from for me.
I definitely want to ask you more about that sort of confidence, or potentially even overconfidence sometimes, of believing that you're going to win in a moment. There's a bit more on this topic that I just want to sort of drill in on. I have this sense that sometimes there's a distinct feeling between the excitement or a positive feeling you get when there's an element of luck involved, in that you get surprised, like, I didn't see that coming and that's fantastic, or something quite new, versus the feeling that you get, the relief of the execution of the plan paid off. And for amateur sports people, I think they're often more fueled by the former one, in that, like, there's more of an element of an unknown, and things can go well some days and not others, and it's very exciting when they go well. And so do you guys find yourselves having to be fueled more by, like, a sense of satisfaction more often rather than excitement? And
I reckon I'd take it back to, so the start of the race at the Olympic final, like the years leading into the Olympics, I used to race at local Canberra regattas, and I'd try to work myself into an absolute nervous tears, because I'm like, I'm going to be so nervous at the Olympics because this matters so much to me. And I'd, try to make myself nervous. But then the reality was that by the time I got to the Olympic final, I was actually remarkably calm on the start line, because it was the realisation that I am never in my life going to be as prepared for something as this.
Right.
So that's where the confidence came from, is that knowing that every session that I'd done, I had done as well as I possibly could have. I believed in the work that I'd done, and that within myself was the best I could possibly be at that point in time. And so for me, confidence has always been about creating that with the training and the practice. And I think that is a bit of the, the relief, that the thing that you backed in, that I believed in my plan and I believed what I was working on actually came to fruition.
Sorry to jump in before you, Scott. I find that quite uplifting to hear, because I, coming into this, thought that there might be a different mindset in the sort of pro-am athlete who sustains themselves by competing against themselves, because their headspace is, well, I'm never going to be the best in the world, so I can't be driven by that. But it sounds like that is what drives you, in the sense of you on that day were like, well, I know that everything was executed as well as possible to date, and that puts me on an incredible platform today. And that's bloody exciting.
Because that's the reality. You don't actually win a gold medal by focusing on the gold medal.
Right.
And so the gamble was that me being the best that I could be would be good enough to win a gold medal.
Yeah.
But other than that, it wasn't a gamble, because I'd trained myself to be in the right headspace to execute the right race at that time.
Right. Got a question to move it across formally to this, like the overconfidence or the pushing yourself into a fairly extreme space. And a bit of a tangent before we get there. When I'm watching the Olympics, I can't watch the gymnastics, right? I struggle to watch it because the routines that they pick, it seems that like half of the athletes stuff up their routine because they've picked something so hard that it's only a 50% chance that they're going to pull it off in the day anyway, or a 20% chance of that kind of thing. And they just have to believe it's only going to be worth it if I throw myself like into it. Anyway, I just find it so heartbreaking to see for the ones that, you know, fall off the pommel horse or something like that. Does that enter into rowing? Like, I think I already know the answer that it doesn't. In the sense of, like, you don't want to strive for something that's greater than what you're capable of doing.
Well, I mean, yeah, like, I mean, because that would apply to everything. But I distinctly remember talking to Drew Ginn, who's another very successful rower.
Mm.
And his words were, to an effect, they were, on the day, there's usually only one crew that actually wants to win the gold medal. So there'll be other crews that will be like, oh, you know, we'll put ourselves out there and see what happens. Or we'll just do the best that we can. But there's usually one crew that's just like, no, this is ours, and we're going to go for it. And so it's not really along what you're saying with in terms of going for too much. It's making sure you actually go for enough. Right. So it's like, you've done all that work. Don't hesitate. You know, like, what's the point of guessing anything? You've just got to put yourself out there, do what you know you can do. And don't leave things to chance. And that's the only real component that I can relate to with what you're saying, is that you're saying that some people really gamble on the chance that this will be pulled off, you know, in terms of they'll do the crazy trick in their gym routine,
right,
50-50 or 80-20, whatever it is, that they land it, and they either do or they don't. Whereas in something like rowing, which doesn't have as much of the split-second make or break kind of stuff, you know, it's a much more kind of prolonged event.
Yeah.
The biggest risk for you is not that you won't land something or like a big moment like that. The biggest risk is that you never actually step off the cliff in the first place. You just kind of hang back and you're not quite sure and you wait and see, and then you've missed your opportunity. The window's closed forever.
Yeah. So it's because in rowing, like, you have far greater control over the system. There's much less of an element of luck compared to in gymnastics, for example. Do you, therefore, what is the role of sort of psychological tactics in rowing? Like, I know, for example, like, no, just, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I've never, like, it's a closed system, you know, so, like, you know, you don't make contact with anyone.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if I ever saw anybody trying, sorry, I'll let you talk in a second, Kimmy, but if you ever saw anybody trying to get in your head, or that was just the, just them showing that they were scared, like, that was it.
Right.
And so no one really ever bothered. So I was always more concerned about people who were just calm and quiet.
Right.
Than I was about anyone who was, like, trying to niggle at me or say a few words or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say, is that, you know, you reach, like, early on in your career, it's kind of like, oh, you know, racing, so focused on your opponent. And then you realise that, like, further down your career, if someone is scared enough of you that they're taking the time and energy to play mind games, that you can choose if you want to play or not. Yeah. And, you know, choosing just not to indulge in that mind game. And I think it's, again, it's having that confidence to do what you set out to do. Often someone might go out really fast, and if you know your speed and you know what you're doing, to stick to it and not deviate from your course because of that. At the same time, I think, you know, both of us are quite naturally competitive, and my challenge has often been I do respond well to, you know, if there's someone chasing me down, or being aware of my opposition actually gives me an energy to, and I think being able to tactically respond to moves and be aware of your surroundings is really important, but not to the extent that I think early in my career I would get quite tense and try harder, which wasn't the same as going faster, to actually understand, it's like, I can see that person there, I can see that person there, I might have to counter that move in a few strokes and I'm going to do it by doing this, but being very controlled in responses.
Is the difference single versus crew in that, like, in a single you can take control of tactics without having to communicate to anybody, and therefore you can think to yourself, I can see that person making a move on me, I'm going to let them...
It's not tactics in terms of mind games, it's tactics in terms of controlling a race. So I think, you know, I often, you get quite a good gauge on what a comfortable distance is. So it potentially is a little bit more strategic like that.
The only difference I found was that in a crew you had to verbalise it. That was the only difference. Otherwise, the strategy is exactly the same. It's a two-game race.
Mm.
You want to win it. And you either know what you need to do because it's in your head and you're on your own. It'd be weird if you're verbalising it to yourself.
Right.
Or if you're in a crew, then you need to be on the same page. And I think the challenge around the crew side of it is making sure that you are actually both on the same page, which can be really challenging.
Mm.
It was certainly something that David and I, so David Crawshay, the guy that I rode with, worked on a lot to make sure that by the time we got to Beijing, we knew, we basically just looked at everything, if not exactly the same, but with the, wanting to have the same outcome.
Right.
You look
confused. So it's really hard to change speed in a crew boat because people try and go faster in different ways. Some might try and row longer, some might try and, you know, put more pressure on the foot stretcher, others might try and rate higher.
Yeah.
But the most important thing in rowing is that you're doing the same thing
right.
together.
Yeah.
And so what Scotty was saying about you either need to know each other so well that you
You can feel that you can
feel
respond
it.
To that, yeah.
Or you need to have your communication so down pat that we need to respond to X crew over there.
Yeah.
In the next stroke, we are going to whatever that is.
Right.
But
generally, that doesn't enter into things too much because the fastest way from A to B is generally at a constant pace, as fast as possible for that constant rate the whole time. Yeah.
And so a lot of, like, you know, what I would find, so rowing with David, would be, say, like, in a high-pressure moment, often he would say to me exactly what I was already thinking. And so that's the kind of goal that you want in a crew where you both know when this happens, then this contingency is what's going to occur.
Yeah.
And usually one person in the boat will be making the calls. It's usually the person sitting behind you just because they're speaking straight at you, which makes it easier.
Yeah.
And so it was really reassuring for me throughout our career that, say, if a crew was moving up on us, I would, like, almost immediately Dave would say, they're moving up a little bit, it's fine, what we're doing here is good, just maintain this, and let's just step at this bit here. And so, and that was all that needed to happen, and then you respond to that, and then keep going. Where the trouble is if, say, I wanted to go, like, jack the rate up a bit higher, for example, and then maybe David's first instinct was to just, you know, row a bit longer and bring the rate back slower. So if you've got people going in different directions, that's where things start falling apart, if you're not on that same page.
I think there might be, you know, one example where your gymnastics example would come into play in rowing. So, you know, you might have 250 metres to go and you're aware that you're still not in front. And you've got a choice there of you might have slightly tricky conditions, a bit of crosswind. You could take the rate up to 45 beats per minute, which is risky that you'll actually take a really bad stroke and slow yourself down a lot. But there is a point that you make a call about how safely you're going to race, or if you're absolutely going to throw everything at it. And this is not a physical thing, because physically you're going to get to the same point, but it's like, okay, there's not making ground, going to have to try something else here.
Yeah.
And I think that ability to, you know, think in the moment to get the best outcome that you can at a particular point in time.
Cool.
Yeah, answering the question that you had originally, but it's a bit tangential getting there, so I don't know if we answered it.
Right. No, so the initial one for this is about almost like an overbelief. Like, you see some athletes who just are so convinced that they're going to win that they get themselves into an overconfident headspace or something like that.
Oh, too confident, you mean? Like, it's detrimental.
Well, it's detrimental in that you can see it afterwards when they come second, they're like ridiculously, unconsolably devastated and they can't see how it didn't happen that they won.
That could be dangerous if that's the training mindset as well, because there's got to be, you can have that quiet confidence in racing, but if you take that approach to every training session that you're going to do, you're not going to be able to challenge yourself to be better enough to realise that you've got so much improvement in you.
Right.
I have to say, if you were certain you were going to win an Olympic final, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, that's not... Like, that's not the right attitude to have. Like, that's just, that's sheer arrogance. So there's belief that you can win.
Yeah.
That's confidence. And you base that on the training you've done, the challenges that you've been through and met. But if you think, I am going to win, that is disrespectful to your opponents. And it's showing a significant lack of insight. If you think you are definitely going to win.
Right. So I'm curious that, can it not be helpful in the sense of, could you have that? Like, is that level of belief? It's fragile. It's fragile, right. Okay, yeah. And unsustainable.
Well, as in, it might help. It might be like your low GI, high GI, in that I think there's a level that confidence gives you the bravado to go out and execute without any doubts about your ability. But as soon as that moment comes where reality hits and, oh, I'm not where I thought I was going to be, or this isn't, I think that shatters so much more than that quiet confidence that this is what I'm capable of. And, you know, irrespective of what is going on at a point in time, that is a lot more resilient than I am the best. And then if you're not...
And I can take on anything, nothing will stop. Yeah, okay.
Because, they may well be the best, but if they're not the best at halfway in the race,
right,
all of a sudden cracks can start appearing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're like, no, I've got it in me to win this, I've just got to do this properly. And then you're like, oh, they're a long way out, I'm going to have to change something here and start working at it.
Yeah.
That's a very different mindset, I think, what Kimmy's getting at, to that idea of like, no, I was supposed to be in front of the field here, and now I'm not, and now I don't know what to do, and I'm cracking under pressure.
Right.
And so potentially they may have still won that race anyway, had they just had the ability to absorb a little bit of the stress. And I think that brittleness that Kimmy mentioned is absolutely spot on when it comes to being overconfident.
Right, okay. Well, that is encouraging to hear, because I was sort of starting to wonder of, like, do events favour a person who's almost crazy? You know, like, that their self-belief is so strong that they somehow... they're in denial, and that, but it doesn't sound like it, because no one can be the best on every single day, and that headspace is going to crack on the days when they're not the best.
Realising as well that what people say and what people feel and think might be very different. I think often you might see that bravado, but yeah. I don't know anyone who genuinely in their heart of hearts even when they appeared so cocky, confident, arrogant, actually had that.
In fact, it could be an absence of it.
Correct.
In ways,
right? So they
love playing up to the media or something like that, because they feel like it gives them a bit of confidence.
Yeah,
back
that brashness.
When,
and,
cool.
Yeah. I mean, because like, if you, the best example of that kind of behaviour was like, I don't know if you watched any Muhammad Ali's kind of theatrics around his stuff, particularly when he went against George Foreman, where everyone thought Foreman was going to destroy him, and Ali was just going to say it was going to be easy and all that kind of stuff. And so he got a lot of confidence out of that kind of behaviour. But for a lot of other athletes, that can actually be a bit detrimental as well, in terms of if you put yourself out there for saying, right, I'm going to be in front and no one's going to come anywhere near me, and then you're not, that can actually bite you in the bum.
Yeah, yeah. Backfires massively. Cool. All right. Thank you. That does answer that. Bit of a segue then to something else I'm quite curious about. So, Jaime Fernandez, you guys know how? I was lucky enough to have him as a schoolboy rowing coach. I think his talent was wasted on me. I certainly never met the body rock that he desired that I would have. But he was a great coach, and I think one of the first people that ever specifically put some effort into training the mental side of me, not just the physical side. And he used to have this saying of answer the questions before they come.
Mm-hmm.
By chance, have you heard him say that? Or
I haven't, but he hasn't coached either of us.
Hasn't coached either of us, but that doesn't surprise me at all. He's a very wise man.
All right. Hey, cool. Yeah. And the way I interpret it being that you'll find yourself in a headspace in the race where questions pop up, or even at 5 a.m. when you're getting up, of the why am I doing it is the classic one. And that if you don't almost neurologically have an instantaneous response to that, you're pretty much already lost then. You're going to hesitate and you're out. Getting a lot of nods is that definitely resonates as something that one needs to do yep. consciously, or does that something just happens?
I think it's a mix. I think so. You need to make a conscious effort, like any part of your training, to be able to basically, I guess, really nail down those pathways of when I need to make a decision, you make it. You know, when the question gets asked, then you answer it. But the way you do that is by actually just basically doing it day in, day out. So in training, when it doesn't really matter, no one's watching, if you back off, you know, then you basically, you reinforce that pathway of giving up when things are getting particularly hard.
Right.
But if even when nobody's watching, you go, right, question's getting asked here, oh, I'm hurting, I need to do this, I've got to sit on this speed, I'm just going to do it, you know. And you practice that, you do it day in, day out when no one's watching, when the whole world's looking at you, it's much easier.
Yeah.
Than when if you always backed off every other time when no one was watching.
Right.
And I think that idea of addressing something early in a safe environment, I hope we don't have any anti-vaxxers listening, but it's kind of like a bit of a vaccination of, you know, you might have that voice that tells you that you're not tall enough, you're not strong enough, you're not whatever it is. And there's no telling you that that voice is not going to come during a race. It probably is. But if you've already dealt with that, that voice is no longer, doesn't hold the power. It's like, oh, there's that voice. I've already dealt with that. Away you go. And it's often in crew boats as well that you can have issues around crew dynamics and how different people are rowing, how they're communicating, things that they do or don't do. And often if you leave those issues, you get to a high-pressure environment and they have so much more potency than if you dealt with them at the time that they emerged. Again, it's like a vaccination for that sort of thing when push comes to shove in a high-pressure environment.
Yeah. There's something I was going to say and then I was sort of thinking there's two separate lines here going at the same time, which one am I going to respond to?
We'll go back to your original question and then we answer it.
So you certainly did. Well, the pointy end of the question got to, is it a conscious process of answering the questions ahead of time or do you incidentally find yourself doing it? And you were saying essentially it happens. You get many, many opportunities to answer the questions and you get better at it.
Yeah.
But
also there is an instinctive component as well, which is what the other half of the answer I wanted to give. Mm. So you've got the deliberate, trained into you because you made these decisions every single day.
Mm.
But also there, I think a lot of, not everybody has it, but I just really enjoy a good scrap. And so, you know, at back end of a race when everyone's quite even and, you know, the question is like, it's there for somebody to take that race. Like, that's my favourite. I love that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so for me, it was never a question. The difficult questions for me came in training because
yeah.
I used to really struggle with just the grind day in, day out. I found that difficult. But racing, I loved it. And, you know, the question never got asked to me by myself of, do I want this or not? It's just why the hell wouldn't you? And then we're here, let's go.
Mm. And so that mindset sounds a lot similar to Kim's earlier on when you're saying you love the third 500 and when things are on a dime and you get that opportunity to play with it and you're like, this, I could just make this mine just through today's my day kind of
yep.
attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. But just the tougher the fight, the more fun it is.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The things come back to me about, I was going to say in response to Kim as well, I've got both in my head at the same time, that you get to this point if you acknowledge that your brain is essentially a thought machine, like that's its job, it creates thoughts. It's it's like your bladder creates urine. It's just going to keep doing that.
Yep.
Like your brain will produce
your these. Your bladder doesn't create urine. Anyway, it's probably good.
Doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just couldn't let that one out.
Right. Okay. We can go into it. Sounded fine for me. and then you get to this headspace where you're like, well, of course it's thrown up those questions. It always does that. It's always just throwing out. It's like a broken record sometimes. Bloody hell, I'm just sick of hearing that even, and it just goes away. Because you're like,
It's just that familiar thought, and, we've been here before. Off you go.
Yeah.
Carry on your way. I'm going to do what I'm doing anyway.
Done. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
See you later. And it's the concurrent thought that was happening was the same as this, what resonated in what you were saying, Scott, about I've found myself, I've made a habit of always completing a training session that I've set for myself. So other than like schoolboy rowing stuff and things like that, in most of my running, it's always been a program set by myself. And you have to have an extremely strong reason or some clearly distinct scenario that's never going to happen again that makes you not do the session that you set out to do, because that's that small win every time everyone's watching. And so you build up this headspace of like, well, every time I set out to do something, I know it's going to happen. There's no question about that because that's what I always do. And if it sucked and I hated it, well, then afterwards, what I need to do work on is thinking, being smarter about what I'm asking myself to do, and sort of get angry at the guy who set the session in the first place. Almost like a splitting of the, deliberate splitting of the identities or personality, no, identities of who's responsible for what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, and kind of like at that early part of what you were just saying there, like, I mean, just like the most kind of simple way of explaining is that you race how you train. And so if you train 90% of your sessions and then back off 10%, there's a pretty good chance that's how you're going to race too. And that is something I'm sure you've seen, Kimmy, as well. But, you know, growing up, going through all the kind of the ranks that, like, I used to be able to train with somebody and tell very quickly exactly when and where in the race they were going to give up. Some people were never going to go from the start. And there were a couple of people who I just know, but about, 500 metres to go or last quarter of the race, they weren't going to have their heart in it. And so that idea that you'll only ever race how you train, so you're kidding yourself if you think you can back off, and then all of a sudden when the pressure's on, suddenly find something that you could never find when there was no pressure on before.
Yeah.
I think it's really not a checkbox thing either, and I think that's where a lot of athletes go wrong, is that this is the training program, I must do 20 kilometres, this is the workload, tick, I've done it, weight session, tick, I've done it. There are a lot of ways that your session needs to have a purpose of what you want to get out of it. It might be aerobic fitness, you might have a technical focus, you might have a mental focus, you might have a combination of all of that, and you judge yourself against the reason that you've done the session, and you're always learning and improving. It's sort of that assumption that, oh, if you win the training session, you're better is not always true, because what was the reason you were doing that session for? Was it to do more sit-ups than someone else, or was it to for a different purpose? And I think that's something that I tend to see a bit of people that don't quite understand and think they're just not as talented, but really they're not applying themselves in the same way to their training.
As in they don't have the same, like, enough intent, is that what you mean? Or?
Yeah, the intent and the intensity of purpose is not there. It's sort of the mere fact that I have done this is enough, not the how have I done this, why have I done this.
And the breaking down of the why, not into just because I want to be better, it's because there's a component of what I do that is the focus of today's session. it seems like a trap for young players or amateurs in general is that like you have an amorphous idea of what better is going to be and how you're going to get there from any given session, and you're just hoping from session to session to session that you're going to improve and that's going to motivate you.
So if you go out and you hit a million golf balls and you don't get any feedback and you don't try and do anything differently, just because you've hit a million golf balls doesn't necessarily mean you will be any better. You're probably going to have a better strike rate. You're going to have less air shots.
Yeah.
But you're probably not going to get the ball in the hole.
Yeah.
So there still is that big element of improvement that is more than the mere fact that you have done X.
Right. And you can improve in a lot of ways at once and almost get more positive reinforcement than you could when everything sort of lumped together as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the sense that you can feel proud that in today's session I accomplished this thing. And whilst it hasn't made me faster rower today, because I was only working on tapping out cleaner or something like that. Well, it probably wouldn't make you faster, but I don't know. Yeah. Like each of the bits, but you still...
Yeah.
Right, okay. The way you're looking at me is like, that's definitely not a conscious process.
I'm just following you through with it, because it, like, what I'm hearing is that kind of major and minor focus that I was talking about before.
Right.
Earlier on, where this is like, you've got this thing that you're focused on, and that's whether you achieve that is the measure of your quality of your session.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I'm just not following you.
What's the distinction between the major and the minor? What would be examples of what's major, what's minor?
Oh, it's not a judgment in terms of what's worth more than the other. It's just at that point in time, this is the priority that we're working on. So
they could flip
anything
on any given day and be... Yeah. Right, okay.
But that's exactly at the end of the session that Scott and David would judge themselves against. So this was our major focus. How did we actually do in executing our major focus? Because there's probably nothing more frustrating than rowing in a crew boat and you set out and you say, look, we're both going to work on our bow side blade placement, and you go and watch video and it's hopeless. It's like, well, why did we say we were going to do that if we weren't actually going to do that? So it's, you know, saying what you're going to do, doing what you say, and following through on that. So you measure yourself against your intent.
That doesn't come easy all the time either, like, because Dave and I had some pretty decent blues out in the water about this kind of stuff, and that's part of it as well, you know, like, because it's difficult to be honest, like really honest with people.
Yeah.
And that once we kind of figured out, David, like, he's much more polite and stuff than I was in the boat anyway, and I was very blunt, and so we kind of reached a bit of a middle ground where we both realised we were working towards the same thing. But to actually be able to say, right, you know, the example was one day I just said, right, stop rowing. And, you know, you can tell this is not going to go
this
well.
This is about to blow up.
And so, and then I just turned around and I just said, do you even want to win a gold medal? And
shots fired.
The thing is, like, there were little things, like questions along the way that we'd ask, that I'd ask to try and see maybe this will work, maybe it work. I was like, all right, I'm just going to, like, just take the shotgun approach here. I'm just going to go bang and just hit him with this and see what happens.
Yeah.
And he got really angry at me. And then he didn't say anything. And then we rode off and he fixed straight away exactly what we'd been struggling with all along. And so then we kind of, once we took the boat in and stuff, and I'm like, okay, so when you're angry at me, you kill it, like you do exactly what you want to do. So what is it that's going on here? What do we need to do? And it was basically what I said to him then was like, when I ask you these things, it's only ever about the boat going faster. It's not about you personally.
Yeah.
It's about us pulling towards this common goal together. And once we kind of realised that any time that I said something, it wasn't a criticism of his ability to be a good rower, it was, this boat needs to go faster, this is how we're going to do it. That was able to then, we could start moving together a bit more, and it wasn't antagonistic. It was like, and he felt free to say, you need to do this, and then I'd be like, cool, and I'd do it. And then other times I'd be like, can you do that? And he would do it. And it was, that was a much more effective way of training together.
That reminds me so much, funnily enough, of working in academia, where it can be absolutely cutthroat at times, and people seem to appear to be vicious with the way that they communicate about other people's ideas. But the culture is such that everyone knows that we're talking about ideas, and everyone's intent is to make ideas a better thing and to arrive at better ideas. And no one ever gets offended when someone's very, like, rough with them. Because we're all just all in the same boat. We're all with the same intent. Yeah,
that's exactly what it's like.
So the, before on the breaking down, I'm just sort of connecting some ideas together as well. The general topic of willpower, right? Like, the question of what is willpower? It seems to be the capacity to follow through on the intent that you had, like, at this point in time, and then a later point in time, you're doing the thing that you said that you were going to do. It seems like one of the... Well, what makes that more doable is when you guys break things down as you do into that minor and major thing, because you, if you only have to follow through on one aspect of your intent, not an amorphous general sort of thing, it's much easier to do than it is if it's...
Yeah, clarity makes things easier, absolutely. Right. So if you've got a clear goal, I mean, that's pretty basic goal-setting stuff, you know, so like if there's a clear target you've got to hit, it's easier to do far and away, whereas I say, like, if you've got a thing, oh, I've got to hit six different targets and I don't know which one's the most important, that's tricky.
Yeah, so you got to come with a framework for why, what are the most important goals, how do I break this all down, and then clear intent, every session, knocking off the bits, building the house.
Mm.
Yeah, cool. Have I missed any, like, glaringly obvious areas of a mental aspect of your sport that...
I wouldn't think so, but willpower is an interesting thing that I feel we only just touched on.
Right,
It gets a lot of airtime and perhaps isn't entirely well spoken about generally.
Right, what's your thoughts on willpower?
Well, I feel like I've been talking too much. Did you?
Oh, no, you go willpower because I was going to say something else.
Because, I mean, your line was willpower in training is it make it easier when you've got a major minor focus as opposed to having lots of different things.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, there's a lot of talk about kind of willpower fatigue and things like that, which I don't necessarily really agree with. And I mean, I'm by no means a psychologist, but I think if you've got enough meaning in what you do, then the idea of willpower becomes almost redundant.
You don't have to overcome something.
And so, like, I don't know for you, but I suspect it was the same for you, or Kimmy, but, like, there was never, it just never really went into my head that I wouldn't get out of bed and go to training, because I just had this, like, just infuriating kind of burning anger to just, I wanted to win that Olympic gold medal.
Right.
And the meaning that that had for me was so strong that, you know, the will didn't really ever factor into it. Yeah. And
You didn't need the willpower. You were going to get up and go to training. It wasn't a question of do I press snooze. It's like, well, no, you don't.
And so I think, like, 'cause a lot of people say, well, how do I get that kind of willpower? And I think it's kind of the horse, like, it's putting the cart before the horse there, because, like, instead of looking for how to find energy to train harder or do something because you want more willpower, I think it's more about finding more meaning in what it is that you're actually striving to do.
Right.
So that the willpower isn't necessarily, like, that's not the end point. The willpower is just the side effect of having such a strong meaning. And so there's a really good book that, if anyone's listening to this, called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Oh, right. Yeah, I just read that earlier this year, actually. Ooh, yeah.
And so his line about, that basically a human being will put up with any how if the why is strong enough.
Right. Because it's all about prisoner of war camps in World War II.
Yeah, so he's a survivor of the Holocaust. Mm. And so that idea that if the why is strong enough, then you'll basically do whatever it is that it takes to get there.
Yeah.
And so people looking for willpower, I would suggest maybe think less about willpower and more about the why of what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, and sorry, Kim, before we get to your idea, it seems like the... to connect that back to some of our previous ideas of that feeling of the why isn't necessarily that high GI motivation, that what intuitive it seems like it must be some incredibly passionate feeling. It's actually almost an invisible why. Like, it's so clear, It's like why having a shower doesn't require any willpower, because it's so clear to you why you're doing it, and it's meaningful because you don't want to smell. You just do it. There's no questions asked. It's just.
But it's also just, like, it's kind of like those still waters run deep, that idea, in terms of like, it's not noisy and like, you know, kind of fantastic and showy, but it's like, it's simple and it's clear, but it's also incredibly deep. And so like a lot of your identity comes out of, you know, the idea of like, I am an Olympic rower or whatever it is, or whatever sport it is that you do. This means a lot to me. This is a huge part of who I am. And so the why then just has this kind of weight to it that means that it kind of pushes anything else out of the way that would try and distract you from doing it. And so it can actually make it a lot, in some ways a lot, even though it's very difficult, it can make it quite easy in terms of it just removes all the choices for you. You're just like, well, I was always going to do this. I can't, I've got no other choice. I'm just going to have to do it.
Right, yeah. I saw this great video the other day that basically described the feeling of that's plaguing sort of our generation is that there's too much choice and people are incapable of doing anything because they're biggest.
They call that paradox syndrome or something.
Yeah, right. Because they're aware, and like, well, the social media makes you aware of so many things you could potentially be or do or something like that, and so they just get indecision. And
yeah,
the feeling of lacking willpower is, it's a product. It's not that you lack willpower. It's just a product of you're in an environment that's not particularly, it's superficially meaningful most of the time. You get snippets of meaning that don't take you anywhere. And so if you want to go somewhere, you've got to put some conscious effort into putting yourself into an environment that is really meaningful in a sustainable way, in a long track kind of way. Wow, right. Yeah,
it's kind of that concept of often you hear people say, oh, you know, the most important thing is that it's fun. But the reality is that, I mean, I wouldn't describe rowing as fun. I'd describe it as really satisfying and meaningful. But it is that meaning over time and purpose, and that, you know, fulfillment of the why is something that's not immediate and exhilarating, but it is, like, over a really long period of time, very meaningful and satisfying.
Something I found very meaningful about, well, more the running than the little bit of rowing that I did, is that it becomes almost like a science of self.
Yep.
That it's a mirror to who you are, and you find that out in the process of drilling down into, well, that we talked a bit about, all the different components.
So, yeah, it's about learning about yourself. So, you know, rowing for me was one way of doing that, but it's not the only way. And I think realizing that fulfillment is a longer term thing than
We learn a lot of ourselves watching Netflix on the couch.
I know.
Very good at making the choice of what you're going to watch tonight.
We like Scandinavian crime dramas.
We do
love it.
But what I was going to say was I listened to an interview of an Australian tennis player, and she'd just been knocked out of the first round of Wimbledon. This was a couple of years back. And she gave a very emotional press conference and sort of saying, oh, you know, I think I was a better player, but I just buckled under the pressure. One of the journalists asked, you know, are you seeing a sports psychologist? And she said, oh, no, I'm not crazy. You know, it'll be fine. And for me, what really struck me with that is that we focus so much on improving ourselves physically. We have the best coaches, biomechanists, physiologists to help us be the best physical specimen that we can be as athletes. And I think it's strange that some athletes find it so confronting or different to have that same dedication to learning more about how to think better and how to mentally prepare better and be calmer and be, you know, have that presence of mind that you want to have come racing. It's like anything else, it's something that you can improve if you explore and you work on. And it's the type of thing that I had the opportunity to work with some amazing psychologists who I learned so much from and had some great conversations with teammates and coaches and peers, where you learn so much and you challenge your thoughts and you think about things, and read some great books about psychology and mindset, and And, you know, you practice things in training, you try, you test, you try again. And that willingness to realise that we can all get better at all aspects. So the mental aspect, the physical aspect, the emotional aspect, it's all part of it. And, you know, it just doesn't make sense to completely neglect the mental side of things because you see it as either you're sick or you're not.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying I'm not going to go to the gym because I can't get any stronger.
Yeah.
Like, that's the idea that, like, are you telling me that your mind is absolutely perfect? Like, you cannot be a better racer. You can't be better under pressure. Nothing. And if that's who you are, fantastic. But I've never met anyone who would fit that bill.
Right.
Without trying, at least. You know, I've met some brilliant racers and things, but they, like, one of the consistent themes I've always seen is that the people at the top of the game are all over the sports psych side of it.
Yeah.
And they've talked about it with professionals, with other athletes. They've opened, you know, they've assessed themselves of how do I fit under this, and they've got professional guidance and things. Whereas I'm constantly surprised by the number of hopefuls, you know, who come and talk to us, you know, because they'll often say from rowing, we'll come along to Kimmy and I and say, what do I need to do? And that kind of reaction to, oh, I'm not crazy. You know, like if you suggest to see a sports psych, it's like, I wasn't saying you're crazy, but I'm just saying you can be better mentally.
Yeah.
Where a lot of people find that a bit of a bridge too far for some reason that I can't fathom.
I've got a bit of theory on it.
Oh, yeah? Hear me.
the distinction, there's some literature on a thing called growth mindset versus a fixed mindset, Caroline Dweck, and the idea behind the fixed mindset, what make it so attractive is that when you have a positive view of yourself and you hold that in a fixed way, in contrast to the growth mindset, you're opening up a way to get worse when you have the sort of the growth mindset, because there's a spectrum of, like, yes, things can get better, but they can also get worse as well, and there's nothing innate about me that is good. It's just a function of the things that I do. But it's a buoying, it helps sustain you in the sense of, like, to believe there's something innate about you that's good. Not quite articulating this how it was in my head. I could just see those athletes when they come to you asking, saying, like, the reason they're coming is because they have this view of, right, I think I'm really good. I think I'm going to make it. Like, I'm clearly that athlete who's got this innate ability. What is it that I have to do in the physical realm to take myself forward? And so they're very threatened by the idea that, no, there's actually nothing innate about you mentally.
Yeah. I don't think there's, like, sorry, I'll just be brief, but, like, I don't think it's saying that there's not so much that there's nothing innate. It's more just that whatever strengths that have got you this far can be made stronger.
Mm.
It's just like the weights that you lift or the cycling kilometres you do, the mind's no different. It's its own version of a muscle. Mm. And you can not train it if you want, but you're giving away a hell of a lot of space to other people who are. So it's just dumb. It's really dumb to not train it.
Mm.
And that's as far as I take it in terms of, I understand how what you're saying there about people might feel threatened because all of a sudden they're not brilliant anymore if someone shows them up to not be. But you can't get better if you already think you're as good as you can be.
It's fixed, yeah.
And if you're coming to us to ask how you can get better, then can you not see the contradiction in that?
Right, yeah.
It's probably, you know, fixed and growth mindset, like anything else, exists on a spectrum. So, you know, you're not going to be innately one or the other, and people can ebb and flow across that. And it seems that there is a lot more growth mindset around train and you will improve physically. And it's probably shifting that to train and you can improve mentally as well. But I think even that awareness of, there's always going to be a balance between some unfounded beliefs that you have about yourself. I think the awareness of what fixed mindset is, what growth mindset is, what those beliefs are, does help move people across the spectrum, maybe.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if there's fundamentally a fear that oh gee, if you're suggesting that I need to work on my mental capacity, that I must be crazy or weak or defective, is we can get better at everything that we do.
Yeah. It's like, to take it back to the house metaphor, it's kind of like, you know, you need a solid foundation on which to build your house. If the mental aspect is the foundation, it's like you're just trying to build your house on the ground. You need a concrete slab, like a well-formed thing that actually sustains the house that you're building. Yeah,
because that's the unshakable part. So it's your head that actually holds everything together.
Yeah.
And so if you do tear a muscle, if you do have a bit of time out, it's what's upstairs is going to keep you on track. And, you know, the body is a changeable thing. You said earlier on that you feel the body outlasts the mind.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, I kind of would disagree with that. And find that it's the mental capacity that will get people across the line 99 times out of 100.
Right. So, I mean it in the sense that it's easier to break the mind than it is... No, that's not true. It's very easy to break the body often as well.
But if your foundation is strong, is what I'm saying, is like if you can build a good foundation...
Right.
Then you've got a mind that basically you just virtually cannot be broken.
Right. So I think that's the crucial thing, is that you need a mind that is stronger than your body is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's, it can either can be stronger or weaker, but without the mind being stronger, then you're screwed.
Yeah.
And by the time you get into Olympic final, those six or so people in that final, it's their mind that is separating the bodies that are all very similar. So in our race, if you look at, say, the podium of our event, there were six guys, all just exactly the same height and build,
right
next to each other. Yeah. Probably all very similar VO2 max, all that kind of junk.
Yeah.
But what separated it wasn't so much the physicality, it was more what was between the ears and what it meant to all those men out there.
Yeah. Awesome. That sounds like a pretty good spot to me to finish things up. Pretty good conclusion. So thank you again, guys. I really appreciate it. I think we got some pretty good insights there.
Well, that was it. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, check out my blog, theendurancemindset.com, for the latest info. And feel free to recommend people to me who you think would have some good stuff to say on this kind of subject matter. Until next time, have a good one.